One morning, about 10 days after Mrs. Churchill's decease, Emma was called downstairs to Mr. Weston, who could not stay 5 days. I'm Ellen.
And I'm Harriet, and this is Reading Jane Austen. And once again, we're joined this week by my partner, Michael.
Hello.
And this week, we're looking at chapters 46 to 50 of Emma. And it's your turn to go first with a 100-word summary.
Okay, so Mrs. Weston tells Emma that Frank and Jane have been secretly engaged. Emma assures Mrs. Weston that she wasn't in love with Frank. Emma's worried about Harriet, but learns that Harriet's in love with Mr. Knightley, not Frank. Emma realises she's in love with Mr. Knightley. Mrs. Weston has called on Jane, who's been suffering under the secret. Mr. Knightley rushes back from London as he's concerned for Emma. She again says she's not in love with Frank, and Mr. Knightley declares his love for her. Mrs. Weston receives a letter from Frank in which he explains everything at great length.
Well, actually, that looks a very good one because mine deals almost entirely with the first half, which you didn't deal with so much.
Okay.
10 days after the return from Box Hill, Frank Churchill tells the Westons that he and Jane Fairfax have been secretly engaged for 9 months. Emma is afraid that this news will distress Harriet, but discovers that Harriet is in love not with Frank Churchill, but with Mr. Knightley, and believes he is in love with her. This reveals to Emma that she is herself in love with Mr. Knightley. Mr. Knightley returns from London and proposes to Emma. Chapter 50 is mostly Frank Churchill's letter of explanation, but also first mention of the Eltons in 5 chapters.
Okay. Well, chapter 46 is the one where the big mystery is finally revealed when Mrs. Weston tells Emma that Frank and Jane have been secretly engaged since October.
Well, I suppose the other major thing that sort of struck me again, mainly as I was reading the beginning of this chapter, is the sort of richness of the demands Jane Austen's making on her reader.
Mm.
That there we are, we've got this chapter, it's got something quite special to say, that Frank Churchill's engaged to Jane. But behind that, we've got this really interesting, all sorts of little hints of the relationship between the Westons.
Mm.
We've got this first picture that Mr. Weston will take notice of what Mrs. Weston says.
Yeah.
She's telling him how to deal with people's feelings.
Mm.
And at the same time, we've also got more and more emphasis on how deeply Mrs. Weston cares about Emma,
mm.
how she's completely involved in her feelings and concerned for it. It's just this feeling. Now, is this part of what makes Jane Austen so good, that she's making these continual demands on the reader? She's not saying, just listen to a little story. Mm. Each time she's telling you a bit more about this one and a bit more about that one.
Isn't it amazing? Mr. I couldn't keep a secret if my life depended on it, Weston, actually manages to do the whole walk from Hartfield to Randalls without telling Emma what's happened. It didn't really strike me until you said that she is telling him how to behave and he is following her instructions.
And he gets there and says, I haven't told her, I haven't told her anything yet. She knows nothing.
I like the fact that Mrs. Weston is, he says about Frank, it has hurt me, Emma, very much. It has hurt his father equally. Some part of his conduct we cannot excuse. Because they just were thinking he was leading Emma on. But Emma is just really angry with him.
First of all, the thing that hits her, one imagines, is how could I ever say that about the Dixons to Frank? It's the sort of the way she has exposed herself.
Mm.
But then she's sort of so critical of him. Impropriety. Oh, Mrs. Weston, it is too calm a censure. Much, much beyond impropriety. It has sunk him. I cannot say how it has sunk him in my opinion. So unlike what a man should be.
And then she goes on to say, none of that upright integrity, that strict adherence to truth and principle, that disdain of trick and littleness which a man should display in every transaction of his life. I wonder who she's thinking about there.
Yeah. But that she doesn't know she's thinking about
it. Yeah, that she doesn't know she's thinking about it. It's just
pulling up her picture of what's right behaviour. Mm.
That's one of the things that I was almost going to say, is the extent to which in these chapters we are constantly given insights into Emma's state of mind.
But the whole book has been like that.
Yes, but I think it's particularly the case here because we're seeing these huge shifts in her thinking. We're going along with her as she goes on this emotional roller coaster.
And that's what this particular set of chapters is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been started up at Box Hill where she's had to sort of think about how she relates to people and how she lets her ideas out too much. But now it's turned into this whole account of her sort of moving from this view of herself to that view of herself. Mm. And how should she be judging herself? What is she to be disapproved of for?
Mm.
And what is sort of all right?
Mm. But of course, after Emma has been so critical of Frank Churchill, Mrs. Weston, having said some part of his conduct we can't excuse, now that she knows Emma hasn't been hurt and Emma is being so negative, Mrs. Weston is suddenly saying, don't let us be severe. Don't let us be in a hurry to condemn him. Let us have patience. But even after Mrs. Weston says we have to be able to forgive Frank, Emma is still really, really annoyed with him.
But I think it's a good example of what I was talking about, because it's clear that Emma's outrage is mostly driven by the fact that his deceit has caused her to publicly embarrass herself.
Well, to do something that she knows she shouldn't have done, she enjoyed doing and she should never have done.
Yes.
And so, you know, she can be angry with Frank Churchill as well as with herself.
Yes.
Yeah. I love the fact that when Mr. Weston basically sticks his head back in and says, have you talked, is it all okay? And, yeah, once he's happy that Emma is okay, it says he now only wanted time and persuasion to think the engagement no very bad thing. Then we come on to chapter 47, which is the big one between Emma and Harriet.
I just love the part where she's waiting for Harriet in such... and Harriet comes in and says, oh, haven't you heard this strange thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of find I don't really have a lot to say about the exchange with Harriet.
Well, she's thinking about Harriet had done nothing to forfeit the regard and interest which had been so voluntarily formed and maintained, or to deserve to be slighted by the person whose counsels had never led her right. She's really just going through shame after shame.
Yeah.
Shame about what she said about Jane Fairfax. Shame about how she's upset Harriet.
Mm.
You know, all these things are happening to her that she has to keep to herself. She's got to rethink her picture of herself at the same time as preserving this social...
Yeah.
Well, she feels she has to preserve this social presence. It's a lovely passage when you get that picture of Harriet's relation to Emma changing.
You suddenly really get hit between the eyes with Harriet has become a lot more confident and a lot more sure of herself and... arguably a bit uppity.
If not uppity, at least she feels she can talk to Emma.
Yeah.
And when Emma says, are you sure he was really interested in you? And she can say, yes. It's what Emma did for her about Mr. Elton.
Yeah.
And now she's learnt to do it herself.
Yeah. Which was what Emma told her to do, to observe him and draw your own conclusions.
Yes.
Because Harriet hasn't just become more confident. She has developed an elevated opinion of herself, which is why she says that she hopes she knows better than to think of Mr. Martin. But it is devastating for Emma because it's almost a reverse. She convinced Harriet in the first instance about Mr. Elton, and Harriet is now almost convincing her about Mr. Knightley. She kind of partly thinks this won't happen, but she still keeps on thinking this will happen.
Well, yes, because she keeps on foreseeing the sort of problems it will cause to the Knightley family.
Yeah.
And she immediately thinks it will be such a disgrace to them.
What I like is the bit after Harriet has gone, we do get told she was bewildered amidst the confusion of all that had rushed on her within the last few hours. Every moment had brought a fresh surprise and every surprise must be a matter of humiliation. But then it says, she sat still, she walked about, she tried her own room, she tried the shrubbery. In every place, every posture, she perceived she had acted most weakly, that she had been imposed on by others in a most mortifying degree, that she had been imposing on herself in a degree yet more mortifying, that she was wretched and should probably find this day but the beginning of wretchedness. Yeah. What I just loved in that was a bit about she sits still, she walks about, she goes to her room, she goes to the shrubbery. Yeah. She just can't settle because she's just having to process so much. And then on top of that, she's having to process the fact that she's in love with Mr. Knightley, and when did that happen? Chapter 48 is sort of a continuation of this emotional turmoil Emma is going through. But then Mrs. Weston turns up and talks about calling on Jane.
And poor Emma has to drag her mind back from that to worrying about the sort of completely unimportant thing now, Jane Fairfax and Frank.
Yeah. From Mrs. Weston, we finally get some insight into what Jane has been going through.
Yes.
Mrs. Weston says that Jane said, "I will not say that since I entered into the engagement I have not had some happy moments, but I can say that I have never known the blessing of one tranquil hour."
Yes. But it's almost a bit hard to take your mind off Emma when you're reading through this. You're not really in the mood for identifying with Jane Fairfax.
Mm.
But that's one of the interesting things about this novel. For any other author, Jane Fairfax would be the heroine of this novel. She is the suffering heroine.
And she blames herself so much.
Yes.
Yes.
I do think it's nice that Emma thinks Jane is better than Frank, and it is fit that fortune should be on his side, for I think the merit will all be on hers.
Yeah, someone says she can pull her mind back to thinking about this.
She's still really angry with Frank.
Yes,
it's a very bitchy statement. It's accurate, but it's bitchy.
And then after that, we get more Emma reflection, because this is where you have the bit where she actually thinks, if she could just think of Mr. Knightley not marrying at all, she'd be happy.
And that's where we start to get her commitment to her father, which is there so deeply at the back of her mind.
It's brought to the forefront. It actually says, "Marriage, in fact, would not do for her. It would be incompatible with what she owed to her father and with what she felt for him." And I think it's nice that it balances both her obligation but also her feelings. It's not just a duty. Nothing should separate her from her father. She would not marry, even if she were asked by Mr. Knightley.
Now, is this the night, there's this wild storm that comes on, and it gives her a miserable night with her father. And this is one of the few times we find where Jane Austen lets us know Emma could feel her father was a bit of a burden.
Yeah.
She says at some point, her father was affected by the storm, and it took a lot of effort to keep him entertained. And it reminds her, wouldn't it be lovely if Mr. Knightley came in?
She's had the conversation with Mrs. Weston about Frank and Jane. Yeah. Then Mrs. Weston is gone, and it's left her to basically beat herself up all over again, feeling guilty about Jane. But then the chapter finishes with this. It's so sad because she's basically just thinking about how lonely it's going to be.
Yes.
Because there's the storm, and it does remind her of the time at the start of the book where they were alone and then Mr. Knightley came and it was nice. And then she thinks about, and the baby's going to come to Randall's and Mrs. Weston will be preoccupied with the baby, so she won't be there. She has spent such a long time being so important to Mrs. Weston, and she has to realise that she's now going to take a second place behind the baby. Then Jane is going to marry Frank and they'll go away together. So that's two more people who you could have rational conversation with who are gone.
And of course, there'll be Mr. Knightley off with Harriet.
Yeah, and then all that were good would be withdrawn. And if to those losses the loss of Donwell were to be added, what would remain of cheerful or of rational society within their reach? Mr. Knightley to be no longer coming there for his evening comfort. It's so sad.
Yes.
It really brings it home that because of her situation, she has to rely on her own internal resources because she has so few external people to rely on.
Yes. The next chapter begins with the continuation of Emma being sad.
The next day when the storm is finished and Emma goes into the garden, it says, "Never had the exquisite sight, smell, sensation of nature, tranquil, warm and brilliant after a storm, been more attractive to her. She longed for the serenity they might gradually introduce."
And what should she see but Mr. Knightley?
And Mr. Knightley being so angry with Frank, like Emma was early when she first learned, but even more so, after he knows Emma wasn't in love with Frank, but before he knows Emma is in love with him, being so not just angry with him, but frustrated that he hasn't got the comeuppance he should have got.
Yeah.
Frank Churchill is indeed the favourite of fortune. Everything turns out for his good. He meets with a young woman at a watering place, gains her affection, cannot even weary her by negligent treatment, and had he and all his family sought round the world for a perfect wife for him, they could not have found her superior. His aunt is in the way. His aunt dies. He has only to speak. His friends are eager to promote his happiness. He has used everybody ill, and they are all delighted to forgive him. He is a fortunate man indeed. To me, it feels like he's just so frustrated that he should have had to pay in some way for everything he's done, and he hasn't. It's just all fallen in his lap.
I think it's an entirely accurate description of Frank Churchill, actually.
Oh, no, it's a very good description of Frank Churchill. Mm.
The whole thing with Mr. Knightley is she's all the time thinking he's in love with Harriet. He's been telling his brother he wants to marry Harriet. He's come back and he's going to talk to Harriet. She just can't let go of that. She's convinced herself that it's going to happen. And Knightley thinks he's being friend-zoned by Emma. I was just wondering, is this another one of the things that Jane Austen is the first person to do? Because she is using the language, I will listen to you as a friend. That terminology has been used again and again and again and again since, but for people actually friend-zoning someone.
In one sense, it could be one of those comic love scenes where they're talking at cross purposes to one another, but it's not. It's a really moving love scene.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten how beautiful it was till I read it again this time.
And as I said a couple of episodes ago when we were talking about Mr. Knightley, he is the one Jane Austen hero who gets a proper proposal. I mean, this is the fourth book. We got zero actual proposals in Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah.
We got kind of half proposals on three occasions in Pride and Prejudice, but all of them had the first line or two and then they devolved into narrative.
Yes.
Mansfield Park, zero proposal between Edmund and Fanny.
Yes.
And then suddenly in this, we get her first full-on
man's side of the proposal. Yeah. Yes.
But even then, she has to kind of undercut it. We've had this wonderful proposal from Mr. Knightley. You know, if I loved you less, I might be able to talk about it more.
Yes.
I won't read it out again because I read it out two episodes ago. But then Emma's immediate reaction is thinking about Harriet.
Yes.
And then we get the, what did she say? Just what she ought, of course. A lady always does.
Which is almost odd that we don't get anything of Emma's feelings as she replies to him.
No. Then we get the recounting of Mr. Knightley's emotions, in some ways almost unnecessary.
I found that a really odd little passage. You've come up to this nice conclusion, and then we've got Jane Austen sort of half mulling it over.
Yeah.
Not doing a deep analysis of it.
Just giving a point by point of what happens.
I mean, when you think what she expects us to be able to have picked up earlier on that was happening, why did she need, I mean, we read what Mr. Knightley said. We know what he was feeling.
So my take was completely different from either of yours. I think it's very deliberate. Yes, this is her first proposal, but it's in no way straightforward. You do have the cross-purposes aspect.
Yes.
I think the reason that we don't hear from Emma is that Jane Austen is recognising that it would be almost impossible for that not to seem to a contemporary reader to be deep into the realm of cliché. Every novel of the 18th and early 19th century had these kind of scenes. I don't see how she could have done it without it feeling like it's bathos, that having spent her time subverting the tired clichés of 18th century romance, this is her recognising that to continue the tone she wants, she needs not to do that.
As you were saying that, I was just thinking, yes, in a sense she's saying, what can I say here that wouldn't sound just like, you know, not just Maria Edgeworth, but all these romantic novels being written. I'm not going to write this stuff.
Yeah. But the bit she does write, the Knightley speech, is so good.
Well, because it's original.
Yeah.
It's not what turns up in all these other proposals. Yeah. But she says, I'm not going to just sit here and repeat this stuff that every minor novelist writes at the end of her novel. I think you're absolutely right. That is probably why she did it.
Yeah, I agree. I do think you're right. I also do love the way that she gives you the emotion, then she steps back and is a little bit funny about it, and then she steps right back at the end of the chapter and is very funny about it, where it says, he had found her agitated and low. Frank Churchill was a villain. He heard her declare that she had never loved him. Frank Churchill's character was not desperate.
Yes.
She was his own Emma by hand and word when they returned into the house. And if he could have thought of Frank Churchill then, he might have deemed him a very good sort of fellow.
Yes, yes.
She's not letting you wallow in the emotion. She's giving it to you and it's real.
Yes.
And it absolutely gets you.
Yes.
But she doesn't let you stay there.
Yes.
The last chapter we're talking about today is chapter 50. And I've got to say, it was really difficult when I was breaking up the chapters for this season to work out where to put the break this time. Because that was the perfect place to finish this episode, but then we would have had too much to cover in the final episode. So I put in chapter 50 here, but I think for most of it, we probably should just hold off on discussing until we're talking about Frank Churchill, because the chapter begins with Emma's emotional journey, and then you get Frank Churchill's letter, but it's in the same chapter, so I felt I had to keep Emma's journey here. So what we're going to have is this week we've got Frank Churchill's letter, and then in the final episode, we're going to have Frank Churchill's letter again as we have Mr. Knightley editorialising on it.
Yes.
But before we get to that, Mr. Knightley has come to tea and they have to pretend nothing's happening because they're having tea with Mr. Woodhouse.
Yes.
Emma's sort of in this fever of emotion, but once he's gone away, she can sort of tranquilise and subdue herself a bit. And this is the bit where a short parley with her own heart produced the most solemn resolution of never quitting her father. She even wept over the idea of it as a sin of thought. While he lived, it must only be an engagement. Then, of course, she cycles back to Harriet again and thinks she really doesn't want to meet Harriet now. Maybe she can get her an invitation to Brunswick Square. But most of chapter 50 is the letter from Frank.
I think everything we might say about this chapter comes much better in a general discussion of Frank Churchill and what people thought of him.
Okay. Favourite sentences. Who wants to go first?
Oh, well, I'll go first then. What I've chosen is Harriet's response to a question by Emma. Emma says, "Have you any idea of Mr. Knightley's returning your affection?" And this is my favourite sentence. "Yes," replied Harriet modestly, "but not fearfully. I must say that I have." I mean, I think that's a sentence that really somehow hits you.
Yeah.
It's hard to say why I think it's such a really good sentence, but I do.
I think it's because what you get here is that she's still being modest about it. So she's gained confidence.
And she hasn't quite realised yet that she's in competition with Emma.
Yeah.
Well, my favourite sentence actually had several on the same page. And I'm going to cheat slightly because I'm going to have two, but they're deeply interconnected and they're short. This is where Emma is reflecting on the conversation she's just had with Harriet. "She was extremely angry with herself. If she could not have been angry with Frank Churchill too, it would have been dreadful."
Yeah, that was one of the ones I half chose. Go on, yours, Harriet.
The one I'm going to go with is, this is from Harriet, talking about Mr. Knightley versus Frank Churchill, saying, "You must think one 500 million times more above me than the other." It was just that 500 million times, that degree of exaggeration is something that feels very modern.
Yes, that sounds like a line from Clueless, from the novel.
In Pride and Prejudice, you've had Mrs. Bennet saying that their dinner was 50 times better than at the Lucases.
Yes.
And I think possibly Lydia at some point says that kind of exaggeration, but 500 million times, I think, is peak exaggeration.
It's so childish.
Yes.
It's almost a 10-year-old's remark.
Yeah. For this episode, the character we're talking about, as we've just said, is Frank Churchill. And I've got to say, I really don't like him. And I think that is probably because I don't feel his charm.
I must say, I don't feel his charm, but I believe he's charming. And that's because Jane Austen has convinced me he's charming by saying how much Mrs. Weston likes him, by showing Emma as finding him, you know, quite reasonable to be with. And of course, truly believing that he's somehow broken through Jane Fairfax's sheath of ice that she's got around herself.
So I think he's one of Jane Austen's least successful creations. I think the issue is that we are told he is charming, but we're not shown it.
I think what we do see, and I've said this over and over again, his vivacity is bringing out Emma's worst side.
But it's not just vivacity, it's frankly sadistic.
Well, this is the question of what is the difference between teasing and sadism? I mean, I think that's the absolutely unforgivable thing about Frank, is that he's put Jane in this position. And then when Emma shows this little slight tendency to be critical of Jane, he leaps on it and he encourages her. I think you're right, it's close to sadism. Yes. But he thinks of himself as a tease.
Yeah.
And poor Jane. I mean, she thinks of him as a tease too. She defends him and she says, "I did not make the allowances," said she, "which I ought to have done, for his temper and spirits, his delightful spirits, and that gaiety, that playfulness of disposition, which under any other circumstances would, I am sure, have been as constantly bewitching to me as they were at first." I mean, that's so sad that somehow or other he managed to get through her barrier.
Mm.
And the awful thing is, having done that, he then betrays it.
I might mention something now that I was going to talk about a bit later, but I have had a couple of emails from a listener called Serene. And one of the things she said is, she's talking about the piano, and she says, "Please give Frank some love and appreciation for that most romantic of gifts." And she expanded on that in the email and also pointed me to a blog post she's written on the piano scene. I'm not going to go through everything she says in detail because she's written it all in the blog. There's a couple of points she made that I wanted to comment on, but just before I do that, up until hearing from her, I have always bought into Mr. Knightley's view about the gift of the piano, which is that it's a bit thoughtless and it's a bit self-serving. And he didn't even think about how are they going to get it up the stairs? Do they have space for it? He didn't think about any of that. And he didn't ask her, he just did it. And Mr. Knightley is very down on that. And I've always kind of bought into Mr. Knightley's view. And I'm guessing you have. And I still think that is there. But what she has said is, "I completely and unapologetically refuse not to acknowledge how happy Jane is about the piano." And that is true. Remember, we even talked about it in the scene. Jane actually has a secret smile when she's looking at the piano.
Yes.
And she says, "Even with its complications, Jane is a musician. She now has her own piano. For the rest of her life, it is hers. And I want to try and remember what a central part of Jane's sense of self music is, and what a central part of their relationship music is." I did think that point, that music is important to Jane, and until Frank sent the piano, she didn't have one. She was sitting there in that small room with her aunt who never stopped talking and her grandmother who couldn't hear anything, and all she could do was sit. Now she has a piano. She can make her music. She can go away into her own thoughts. And that is a gift. That is something that is magic for her. And I had not thought of that. So I want to give credit for making me see that side of it.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. The problem is that both are true.
Yes, yes, I'm not denying it is also thoughtless.
Yes, but structurally in the novel, firstly, at the point it arrives, the reader does not know it is sent it. But secondly, almost immediately, we get Mr. Knightley's comments shaping our reaction to it.
Yeah.
So I think that's a problem with how it's presented and how that part of the novel is structured.
It's also, can we believe that Frank Churchill had that level of insight?
I think we have to. Look, I know Michael doesn't entirely agree with me on this, but I do genuinely think Frank Churchill, insofar as it is in his nature, which may perhaps be a little on the shallow side, he does love Jane. And I think, yes, he wanted to be able to think to himself, "I did this good thing for Jane." But that was driven partly by self-aggrandizement, but also partly by he wanted Jane to be happy. He wanted Jane to be able to make her music. I'm not saying that Mr. Knightley's point of view is wrong or that I disagree. I'm just saying I didn't give credit to the other side. You know, people are not simple. I think Jane Austen is asking us to see the flaws in Frank. Everyone in the book says that Jane is better than Frank. And I think Jane deserves better. And I think everyone in the book does feel that Jane will help Frank become a better person.
I'm not sure if I feel that so much as what I think of is the enormous amount of pain he's going to cause her all through their marriage. He's going to be continually doing and saying things that Jane feels are wrong, that she feels are upsetting, and she'll still probably stay in love with him in spite of it all.
It's hard to see that cruelty disappearing.
I agree. I have concerns about the long-term happiness of that marriage. What? Concerns about Jane's long-term happiness. Yeah. I think Frank will stay in love with Jane. I don't think he'll change completely. I think he is going to cause her pain. Now, just harking back to Frank being sadistic and the whole Dixon thing that he does with Emma. Again, it's what Serene said in her blog post about the piano scene. And I'm kind of expanding on what she said here because it made me think. She says anytime Frank is talking about Colonel Campbell and Emma thinks he's talking about Mr. Dixon, Colonel Campbell must have known how much you love music, that sort of thing.
Yes.
He's actually talking about himself. He's saying, I know how much you love music.
That's a terribly good point, isn't it?
But it is.
She says, he totally does many questionable things. But what he does not do is say anything that could be taken by anyone but Emma as Mr. Dixon. And when Frank says Colonel Campbell to Jane, he clearly means himself because he's declaring his love for her, not Colonel Campbell's. I think that is a great insight, but I also slightly disagree with it. Because I believe, and I don't know if we've got evidence for it, but I believe at this stage he has already told Jane about the Mr. Dixon thing.
Oh, I'm sure. And I'm so, absolutely sure he's
and so
told
when he,
Jane.
But he is saying that. This means it's not a conversation happening on two levels with him and Emma and Jane knowing Mr. Dixon and everyone else thinking he's saying Colonel Campbell. It's incredible. It's happening on three levels. Mrs. Weston thinks he's talking about Colonel Campbell. But then Emma thinks he's having this private joke with her about Mr. Dixon that she's hoping Jane hasn't picked up on. And Jane knows that he's saying Mr. Dixon because that's what Emma thinks and he's having a joke about it to her as well as to Emma, even though it's mean to her, but she's still thinking it's his playful spirits and I shouldn't be hurt about it. Mm-hmm. But then you've got this other level as well where Jane also knows that he's not really saying Mr. Dixon, he's really saying I. It's like, how many levels can you put into one conversation?
Well, implicit in that is another layer of cruelty, which is he wants Jane to know that he's being cruel to Emma.
That was kind of what I meant.
He's almost pretending to Jane he's on her side against Emma, whereas there's no way she wants him to be on her side against Emma.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
wants them to wipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't want Emma in the equation. I think if you had that scene without the Mr. Dixon level, if Emma had never said to Frank the Mr. Dixon thing, so everything Frank said, he was saying Colonel Campbell. And that would be the language of love to Jane because she would know he's
Indeed.
Talking about himself.
Yes, it would be, again, more what Mr. Knightley said, a very young man saying things that put her on tenterhooks, but she could take them as nice.
And
whereas this has got this nasty thing.
Yeah. Basically, he's trying to have it both ways. He's trying to have a laugh with Emma. Against Jane, and he's also having a laugh with Jane against Emma.
Yes.
But it's also unbelievable that he could believe that Jane is having a laugh about it.
Yes. But Jane, as we said, talks about his gaiety and playfulness.
And she has to tell herself it's playfulness and I'm being unreasonable because otherwise the alternative is too horrible.
Yes.
So I was thinking, is Frank Churchill unreadable as sympathetic in a post-Me Too world? The visible power and abuse of power that he exemplifies is deeply problematic. And I think it's particularly striking because one of the great contributions of Jane Austen's work is in her way her novels have been about women's lack of power, their lack of agency, and how difficult it is for them, regardless of their virtues, to make their way in a world where the rules are stacked against them.
Except, I mean, what you can say about Frank Churchill is he has been in this sort of subservient, almost female position to Mrs. Churchill. He's had to use his charm on her to get what he wants. Some of the things you can say about the female position relate to his relationship to his aunt. And some of the things he's done have been the sort of fairly unworthy things. Now, the sort of things that people like Mary Wollstonecraft said was so awful about women. She says, you know, if they want any power, they have to get it by these underhand means, by charming men, by tricking them. But people, other people picked it up from her. And Frank Churchill has been in that dependent position to his aunt. And using these supposedly female characteristics to get his own way.
But in terms of being under control of a woman, we saw that in Sense and Sensibility, with both Edward and Willoughby are financially under the control of a somewhat dominating woman.
Willoughby doesn't have to be.
No, Willoughby does have to be if he wants to live his life.
If he wants the lifestyle he wants, and I suppose you can say the same of Frank Churchill,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. If Frank Churchill had become engaged to Jane, told his aunt and uncle immediately, and they had cast him off, he would not have been destitute. For a start, he could have just come and live with his father. It's not like he had no choice. Something that struck me when I was reading his letter in chapter 50 is it comes across to me so much like Willoughby's defence to Eleanor. It's so very self-serving.
That's how I feel reading it too.
The whole letter is very disingenuous, and it's also, I will put myself down because I know that if I do that, then you will instantly feel obliged to say, yes. Oh, no, it's all right.
And that's one of the reasons why reading it, I had narcissistic sociopath in my head. We see no evidence whatsoever of his affection for Jane.
See, I disagree with that. He's always doing everything he can to catch a few minutes with her.
And finding little good excuses like fixing Mrs. Bates's glasses.
Yeah.
And
or, you know, after the ball, dropping off whatever it was he'd borrowed so he can go there before he leaves and spend some time there. This was also something Serene said in the blog post about the piano scene. If you look at this scene, focusing exactly on what Frank's doing, the number of times he is turning backflips to attract Emma's attention, it's so that Jane can have a few moments to gather her emotions. I do think he genuinely loves Jane, and I do think we have evidence for it. It's not something we have to make up. It is something we have to deduce rather than seeing. But I don't think that means it's not there.
I think we have to retrospectively go back and give it greater weight. But the problem is, at the time, Jane Austen has been actively working against us, giving it weight.
Working against us is what she does for almost the whole of Emma.
Yeah.
She's all continually misdirecting the reader.
Yeah. I think wherever you end up standing in your view of Frank Churchill, and there's the whole spectrum of he's the worst thing ever to he's actually not a bad chap at all.
We have Mr. Knightley going through that, don't we?
Yeah, that whole spectrum Mr. Knightley goes through. But I do think, though, it is written for rereading. There is just so much in Emma that you don't get on a first time through. I think we have to assume Jane Austen expected people to reread. And again, maybe this is something that Jane Austen was one of the first people to do. I don't know. But
I'm quite prepared to accept that was Jane Austen's contention. I think he's a failed authorial construct, at least for many 21st century readers, if the aim is for one to have a sympathetic view of him at the end.
We don't know what Jane Austen's intentions were. I don't think she intended us to have a fully sympathetic view. It's a question of where we're meant to be on that spectrum. And at the end of the day, death of the author and all that sort of thing, we make up our own minds.
Indeed.
I would disagree with you in saying he is a failure, because I think the fact that we have now been talking for 45 minutes about him suggests that this is not a failed character. This is a character that there are so many nuances you can talk about.
Yeah, no, I couldn't accept him as a failed character at all. What I've been saying all the time is I believe Jane Austen. I believe he was charming.
Yeah.
I believe he was good looking, and he was good looking in a way that he exploited in terms of charm. Yeah. I mean, I don't say I like Frank Churchill, but I don't feel that's any sort of failure of Jane Austen's. I feel, as far as I'm concerned, he's a character that rings completely true.
Well, of course, the reason Michael is here for this episode is because he's going to be doing the historical discussion part.
We all had some doubts as to whether I would be putting in another appearance in this season. However, after talking with Harriet, and after being inspired by Frank Churchill's visit to London for a haircut, we decided that I could talk about how the lifestyle of men of the gentry class were changing from those of the 18th century. So it should be obvious to even the most casual viewer that Regency gentlemen looked very different from their fathers and grandfathers. Periwigs and powder combined with knee breeches and buckled shoes have in the Regency largely given way to men wearing their own hair with trousers or riding breeches, combined with looser-fitting coats and waistcoats more suitable for manly pursuits such as hunting and shooting. So I have no intention of setting myself up as a fashion historian. I am happy to leave that to those with far greater expertise, like Hilary Davidson or Bernadette Banner. So what I thought I'd do is attempt to contextualise these changes in men's fashions in terms of the broader social and political developments that influence them. Essentially, I want to point out that the changes in Regency's men's appearance, so beloved of Hollywood and BBC costume dramas, are reflections of the massive changes sweeping across Britain and Europe at the time. The latter part of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century were a time when political and economic power were fundamentally changing. The most obvious examples of this are probably the American and French revolutions, although I would argue that these are the culmination of an undermining of the power of royalty and the aristocracy that goes back to the late Middle Ages. So as I've talked about before, the defining feature of Britain in Jane Austen's time was almost continuous war with France. Despite these hostilities, however, French ideas, and in particular French fashions, continued to be hugely influential in Britain. However, what was more unusual, almost unique in fashion history, is that at this time, revolutionary and Napoleonic France saw widespread Anglomania. The new Paris elites increasingly adopt le style anglais, a fashion aesthetic based quite explicitly on the clothes of the English gentry, professional and mercantile classes. And this adaptation by the fashionable French only increased long-standing social trends in Britain. The gentry class Jane Austen was part of and wrote about looked less and less to the royal family or the remains of the English aristocracy as models for manners, leisure pursuits, what to read or how to dress. Instead, perhaps for the first time, the upper echelons of British society, the aristocracy, such as Lord Byron and Beau Brummel, were actually adopting styles from the gentry class. So this is something we've talked about on the podcast and again and again and again, that despite the impression that many of the adaptations give, the gentry class are not the aristocracy. They are completely different in almost every way. So what we see, and I think this is very important for the beginning of modernity, for the world we live in, is a shift in social power away from the traditional elites and the gentry class and the closely related professional and mercantile classes becoming the drivers of fashions, of social mores, of pursuits, in a way that would become even more apparent in the Victorian era to come. As I've talked about before, most English gentlemen felt no desire to actually fight for their country during these ongoing wars. But what we do see, however, during this period is a move towards a more active physical masculinity, a precursor of the muscular Christianity that was such a characteristic of the class in the Victorian era. A gentleman was expected to be a competent rider, capable of following the hunting pack across ditches, hedges, and through woodland, as well as a decent shot with sporting guns. There was also a move towards a growing popularity for other military and quasi-military pursuits. Fencing becomes fashionable again in Britain, with the military sabre as well as the foil, although it should be said the English maintained their reputation as far and away the worst swordsmen in Europe. Another one which we might not think of as a military accomplishment is swimming, but swimming also becomes fashionable in part because of Lord Byron's alleged swimming the Hellespont. in the Regency, we do see the beginnings of modern notions of exercise as the basis for good health. This is a reflection of the fact that in the Regency, the ideal male body is becoming more muscular. And one consequence of this is that men unable to develop this muscular body, particularly the heavily fashionable large calf muscles, began to use padded falsies.
Sawdust, in fact.
Sawdust, indeed. Again, in an interesting precursor of 20th century fashion trends, Regency gentlemen, far from looking up to the aristocracy for their fashion trends, began to look down and to adopt fashions and pastimes from the lower classes. Regency bucks could be seen wearing jockeys' riding boots and caps, though not wearing them as often as they do in every adaptation. The other thing that both fascinates and appalled foreign visitors to Regency England was the English gentry's enthusiasm for pugilism. In particular, their desire to spar themselves rather than just watch the lower orders beat the hell out of one another. However, because of this, and because of not wanting to run the same risks as professional pugilists, this is the period where one first starts to see the development of rules and limitations on boxing, what would become the Marquess of Queensbury rules. Those included timed rounds, a ban on wrestling and throwing, and this would lead ultimately to modern boxing. In this move by the gentry class to embrace various physical pursuits like fencing, like boxing, we're also in this period beginning to see that happening with cricket and football. We start to see the beginning of rules and regulations and the beginning of what becomes modern sport. So, whilst utility and increasing physical activity played a large part in the shift in the gentry's clothing, one should not overlook other influences. Revolutionary and Napoleonic French aesthetics were strongly influenced by classical Roman models, and Frank Churchill's London haircut may well have been in the fashionable Brutus style, which was inspired by Roman statuary and busts. The major changes in military uniforms also undoubtedly had a large influence on the change in this style of men's coats, for example. My own personal opinion is that most writers on men's fashions of the period may well overestimate the influence of aristocratic figures like Lord Byron and Beau Brummel on the fashions of the gentry of the period, whilst significantly underestimating that of what we would call in the 21st century those mega influences, Napoleon Bonaparte and Arthur Wellesley, latterly the Duke of Wellington, both of whom were known for the simple elegance of their dress. Wellington, of course, was famous for eschewing knee breeches in favour of trousers and wearing Hessian boots rather than court shoes, etc. And around the Peace of Amiens, Britain goes through a brief period where at least some in the gentry class are looking very favourably upon Napoleon as a role model. They see him as a readjustment away from the excesses of the revolution, and therefore his style of dress again is another influence on how the English gentry are dressing. And at the same time, it is important to recognise that portraits of Napoleon and the Duke of Wellington were everywhere at the period.
Just before I start on the pop culture section today, I wanted to briefly mention again the talk I gave at the JASNA conference last year about screen representations of Darcy. I gave that talk again to the Jane Austen Society in Australia, and it was recorded and is now available on YouTube, so I will put a link to it in the show notes. Now, in Emma, I've now talked about all of the screen adaptations of Emma I've been able to get hold of, so I'm going to spend the last two episodes talking about book adaptations. And today, what I want to talk about is modernizations of Emma. And there have been a huge number of them, but I'm just going to talk about three of them that I've read recently. The first one is Emma, A Modern Retelling by Alexander McCall Smith from 2014. This was part of the Austen Project that you remember I talked about with Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice. The Sense and Sensibility followed the plot of the novel fairly closely. Eligible, which was Pride and Prejudice, followed it fairly loosely. This is kind of in between. This one is set in an English village, but it's set in Norfolk rather than in Surrey. And almost the first third of the book is before Emma, the novel, even begins. Mr. Woodhouse is reclusive and protective and has been, as in the 2009 TV series, very affected by the death of Mrs. Woodhouse. He has health fads, but he is very intelligent. He's an engineer and he's living off the proceeds of a patent for an invention he made some time ago.
Hard to imagine Mr. Woodhouse as an engineer.
Well, has been an engineer, perhaps one should say. He now just stays at home and doesn't go anywhere. Mrs. Goddard runs an English for Foreign Students school that Harriet kind of helps out with. Frank has actually been living not in Yorkshire, but in Australia. Not quite equivalent in terms of distance, but
you could get from Australia to Yorkshire in 24 hours.
Yeah.
You couldn't get from Yorkshire to London in 24 hours.
Yeah. Actually, it's less than that because they were living in Western Australia. So that's 5 hours less than it is from Sydney.
Yeah.
The next one I looked at is The Emma Project by Sonali Dev. That was published in 2022. This one is set in San Francisco. And it's the fourth in her series about an immigrant Indian family called the Rajas. They're wealthy, they're privileged, they're politically very ambitious. And I listened to an interview with the author where she described them as basically being like an Indian version of the Kennedy family. There are four books in this series. The first one was Pride, Prejudice and Other Flavours. The second one is Recipe for Persuasion. The third one is Incense and Sensibility. And the fourth one is The Emma Project. One thing with this is because she's mostly dealing with members of the same, somewhat extended, but basically the same family, there's a bit of repurposing. So, for example, in Pride, Prejudice and Other Flavours, which is gender switch, so that the Georgiana equivalent is one of the sons of the family. And yet, when we come to Incense and Sensibility, the character who was Georgiana has become Edward Ferrars. And the character who is the Lucy Steele equivalent, she becomes Knightley in the Emma Project. You don't actually get to see inside her head in Incense and Sensibility, but it is a little bit of cognitive dissonance to realise that the same character is fulfilling two different roles as it was for Georgiana Darcy to morph into Edward Ferrars. So the Emma equivalent is Vansh Raja, the youngest member of this family. He was mentioned in the earlier books, but he didn't really appear. So there was no baggage with him as there was with her. Because this is part of a series, it doesn't follow the plot point for point, even as much as the Alexander McCall Smith Emma did. This one is further from it, but there are still touch points, there are connections. You do have a bit of a Frank Jane plot. You do have a little bit of the Harriet plot, but not so much. You can see the Emma influences in it, but like Clueless, it's not trying to just recreate it. A couple of things the author Sonali Dev said in this interview I listened to is that one of the lessons she takes from Emma is that Emma is a person who has more and believes that therefore she knows more.
I think that's a very good summary of Emma.
Yeah. And what connects these two characters is they are both trying to achieve something. The Knightley character, the older woman, has been working for a long time on opportunities for women in developing countries. While the Emma equivalent, Vansh Raji, he has got all enthusiastic about getting capital to build a support network for homeless people in San Francisco. So they're both coming from good places, but what Sonali Dev said is, as she feels with Emma, they have more and believe they know more, and it's about the haves making decisions for the have-nots and people who have everything trying to change the world. So she's kind of sort of critical of it, but at the same time recognising that they are both coming from well-meaning places, which of course is where Emma is coming from.
Yes.
And it is also coming from the fact that the author grew up in India and got into Jane Austen. And then this is her sort of relating it to other parts of her real world experience. The third one I looked at is Emma of 83rd Street by Audrey Bellezza and Emily Harding, and it was published in 2023. It is set in New York, and Emma and her father and her sister are, again, a very privileged family. As with the Alexander McCall Smith version, more of a thing is made of the death of Emma's mother and the fact that her father is a little bit adrift. There is no Mrs. Weston in this one. That role is taken by Emma's sister, who basically gets married early on in the book and is pregnant with a pregnancy kind of mapping to Mrs. Weston's pregnancy. Mm. So it's perhaps a little closer to mapping point to point for the book, but it's not a true let's make sure we hit everything in the book. Emma loves the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In fact, she's hoping to get an internship working there. And she and Knightley go there at one point and they look at a Klimt painting called Meda Primavesi, which Knightley says it's his favourite painting in the collection because it reminds him of Emma. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes because I had to look it up myself. What it is a young girl in a white dress against a purple background. But looking at it, she's standing there, she's got one hand on her hip, and she's just looking directly at the viewer. And looking at that, I can actually see that as a young Emma.
As long as she's under 15.
Yes. No. It's not Jane Austen's Emma aged nearly 21.
No.
Nor indeed the 23, 24-year-old Emma of this book. It is definitely the younger girl, but I can see it. It works for me. That's a really high-level picture of the three books I looked at. And I just wanted to make some general comments comparing some of them. In both The Emma Project and Emma of 83rd Street, the Harriet equivalent doesn't end up with Mr. Martin.
Oh.
Because in both of those books, it's actually not a good relationship. Whereas by contrast, in the Alexander McCall Smith version, Harriet reveals at the end that she has actually secretly been seeing Mr. Martin the whole time. Emma thought she wasn't.
Oh, right.
A parallel is that in Alexander McCall Smith's version, the Emma character has studied design and wants to start a business. In Emma of 83rd Street, she's studying fine art and wants to get an internship at the Met. What they're following through with there maybe is Emma's painting, but in this case, she is following through with it in both cases. But the most fascinating thing is that with both the Emma Project and Emma of 83rd Street, the primary focus is very much on the Emma Knightley romance. That's what the book is about. In both of these books, we get a lot of Knightley perspective as well as Emma perspective. And we get physical attraction they are both feeling from the others from a very early stage. And both books have fairly extensive sex scenes at the end. I'm not saying there aren't other aspects, and particularly, as I said, in The Emma Project, like Sonali Dev said about the haves trying to make decisions for the have-nots and trying to change the world. But the main plot thread is romance, and in a way that made me realise how much it isn't in Emma, perhaps less than any of the others, do you get the Emma Knightley romance as a thing going through. So it really made me appreciate just the richness of how much else you get in Emma. Because when you're focusing so much on Emma and Knightley, the other stuff kind of is lost a little bit more.
That was one of the things that I felt, you know, talking about it today, one of the things I thought was, where's everybody else in Highbury? There's nobody in here except Emma and Knightley. Mm. And this is not Emma. Yeah. Emma is this book with all these people.
Yeah, Emma is three or four families. It's not two people. So that was those three books. For our final episode next time, I'm going to be looking at books that are not modernisations, but rather are retelling the story of Emma in the original setting, but from the point of view of different characters. You've been listening to the Reading Jane Austen podcast with me, Harriet.
Me, Michael.
And me, Ellen. In our next episode, we'll be finishing up Emma with chapters 51 to 55.
The structure of this podcast was inspired by Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Our music is Creative Commons performances of pieces Jane Austen might have listened to.
You can find us on our website, readingjaneausten.com. We're also on Facebook at Reading Jane Austen and Instagram at reading_Jane_Austen.
You can email us at readingjaneaustin.com or rate and review us in your podcast app. We hope you'll join us next time.